Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for preachers and teachers. I am Paul Esser, PhD student in Hebrew Bible at Yale University.
And I'm Rosie Candlethal, a Louisville Institute Fellow at Columbia Theological Seminary in the area of Hebrew Bible. Our co-hosts, Rachel Wren and Tim McNinch, are off this week. And it is still Lent, folks. And Easter is around the corner as well. We have preaching tips and insights for Sunday, March 17th, from Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 to 34. Paul is here to help us out. And Paul, what do you think? What are we going to do with this passage?
Yeah, we talk a lot about Isaiah on this podcast. And in the lectionary, there's a lot of passages on Isaiah. So I'm excited about the change today. Although I do not think that Jeremiah and Isaiah are widely different in any way, they seem to be saying pretty much the same things and similar things most of the time. But as usual, I think that it would be good for us to start with some basic context and background stuff, especially with prophetic literature. It's very difficult. It's not narrative all the time. So it's very difficult to figure out where we are in terms of history and all that. So just a little bit of the historical background. And as we know, Israel's life interacted with major empires of its day over several events and times with a fairly complicated history. Chronology is not even something we can even really talk about because it's very messy. But the two major ones, I'm talking about empires here, were Assyria and Babylonia. And in 627, if my history is right, vassal nations of the Assyrian Empire revolted, including yours truly, Judah, led by King Josiah. And the guy who went on to launch the massive religious reform in 2 Kings 22 through 23, and I think it's also recorded in 2 Chronicles 34 through chapter 35. So Josiah is one of the few good kings of Judah according to the Bible, but sadly he dies, right? And after he died, Jehoiakim takes over, and at this point, Babylon is in charge of the region. So Judah tried a revolt against Babylon twice, and within this sort of short period of time, one under Jehoiakim in 597, if I'm right, and another by Judah's last king, Zedekiah, 587. And it was the last one, the last revolt by Zedekiah in 587 that really triggered the mass, big, grand exile in 587 when Judah's elite were deported and sent in droves to Babylon. That's the same exile that we read about in Daniel and in several other passages in the Hebrew Bible. But I bring all of this up to say that Jeremiah's prophetic ministry interacted with some of these major events in Israel's history. And across all of the 52-chapter-long book, he uttered several oracles and poems of different kinds addressing different situations within this broad context that I have just outlined. Some of the oracles are judgment oracles, others are salvation and deliverance. But here in chapter 31, the passage that we have in the lectionary, if you read the whole thing, he seems to be addressing both Judah and Israel at different periods, just before or during or soon after the 587 exile, right? That's what he seems to be doing. For example, in chapter 31, verse 1, he says, "The people who survived the sword shall find grace in the wilderness." Clearly, this is exilic, right? He's talking about the remnants of the exile. In verse 13, he says something about turning their mourning into joy and sorrow into gladness, and all of these really like interesting things about the people who remained or the people who left or the people who left and are returning back home to Judah. Jeremiah 31 from 31 to 34, our passage for today, is one of those oracles of hope, as I see, and it is set clearly within the context of a great devastation, a devastation that we call exile, right, in the Hebrew Bible.
It's really helpful to have the broad overview because we've got this tiny little snippet, right? Yeah. So the RCL just takes verses 31 to 34, and if you are only looking at this oracle of hope, and not looking at it in its largest context, you really are missing out on the prophetic turn that's happening here if you're not actually seeing the kind of surprise that there is any hope in the midst of all this devastation.
That's right.
So why are we focused here on 31 to 34?
So in 31 through 34 of Jeremiah chapter 31, we're seeing this passage about a covenant with Israel, right? This is God making a covenant with Israel. And there are two distinctive things about it here that, at least for me, I see worth highlighting. And of course, there are multiple things, but the two things that I see is the time of the covenant, and the prophetic oracle describes it as something in the future, right? It's coming. The language of it's coming. Yamim Bayim, right? Something is coming. A day is coming. So it's not here. It's not in the present, but it's in the future. And then number two, it's a new covenant. Berit Chadasha, right? It's a new. And the language of it being new immediately triggers thoughts about old, like the old covenant or the possibility of there being an old covenant. And there was an old covenant, right? In, I think, somewhere in Exodus. But verse 32, the very next verse after 31, where we see this language of a new covenant coming up, helps us understand a few more things about this new berit, right? This new covenant that God is making with Israel. A few things. The old one was with the previous generation of Israel. And because of that, it recalls the Exodus. There's something about Egypt and the Sinai and then the Sea of Reeds and all of that, like way back in Israel's history. But it also recalls that the old covenant did not work mainly because of Israel's response or lack thereof, not God's. I like the way verse 32 says it. It says, "It will not be like the covenant that I made with your ancestors when I took them by hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt." Then there's a little line there. "A covenant that they broke, though I was their husband," says the Lord. It's like God is like very comically and very hastily snitching on them and say, "Yeah, there's a covenant that I made with you guys. I intended for the covenant to work, but it didn't work, and it's on you. It's not on me," right? This is a really interesting way that God puts it.
Right. So God is laying out a case, right, that there was this old covenant. It did not work. It was broken, not God's fault, but the people's, right? And using this kind of metaphor of husband and wife and fidelity and lack of loyalty, right? So this is a common prophetic trope, particularly by the time of Jeremiah, something that's now accepted in the water of the recognition of what a covenant looks like, mirrored by human relationships of husband and wife.
That's right.
Yeah. So then maybe what's going on in this new covenant? What's shifting here?
Yeah. So like in this new covenant, we see very interesting things. The covenant, as I read it in verse 33, is essentially, "I will be their God. They shall be my people." Like, really simple. But the way to ensure the success of this new covenant is quite different and is really radical, in that the old covenant's success was based on the people teaching the law and obeying it, right? That's the law. So here, God is scratching that and instead putting the law within them and writing it upon their hearts. That's what verse 33 says, that I'm gonna put the law within you and I'm gonna write it upon your heart. And I think here there are three things. There's something about permanence, there's something about remembrance, and there's something about the law, right? And how are all these three things related? First of all, note that the law is not changing. It's still the same Mosaic law, still the same old law. It is the means to the fulfillment of the law that is changing. And also, there is a requirement for obedience that is assumed here. It's like the success of this covenant is based on the law. And it is when you obey and follow the law that we are in a relationship or this whatever covenant that is, right? And so obeying the law, therefore, is practically dependent on how one knows and remembers the law. And I guess the way to fixing the problem that happened the first time in the old covenant is to put it within them and engrave it upon their hearts, theoretically solving the problem of maybe forgetting, and therefore ensuring that they obey this new law. This comes to light for me. This reading that I'm doing right now comes to light even more for me in verse 34, when it says, "There would not be a need to teach to lamad," right? To teach one another to know God, right? After I have put it in you and engraved it on your heart, there's no need to teach it anymore. And the word for lamad here, which is to teach, really means like skill. but it also means exercise, right? To rehearse a skill over and over until mastery, until a point where like you could just basically do it from your bed. But the thing that is unclear in the passage is how God is going to do this sort of inscribing of the law. How is God going to do the inscribing of the law upon their hearts? And it's really interesting. I really like the motif because it does remind me of Ezekiel, where God makes a similar claim about obedience to covenants. But there, the solution to disobedience is not to put the law inside them, but it's rather to replace their hearts. Right? He says, I put in them a new spirit and switch out the stony rebellious heart with one of flesh. So I see a similar process here. It looks as though the point of the covenant is this sort of inward transformation of a human heart that will allow people to know God intimately and to be obedient to the commandments of the law.
I think that's really inspiring on some level because it's almost as though you're talking about a rewiring, a new DNA being woven into the spirit or the being of the people. So they're being re-networked so that what was considered the problem earlier could be addressed in this way, right? So that no longer would there be any barriers in the relationship. The covenant could go forth, the blessings could be received. God is committed to this process that it's going to be innate. It's going to be the skill that you will just be able to have in the world and hold out to the world. Beautiful. But as we think about preaching, do you have any particular kind of tips or angles that you would offer to the preacher that's preparing to preach this week?
That's right. I think that basically everything that we have talked about exegetically are potential preaching tips. And I would say like any of them would work quite okay for preaching. But I love the word new. And I love the idea of new covenant and new life and new energy and new relationship and all that. I'm in the midst of all of it as well with the brand new baby coming in the next few months. So plus all the changes that this new baby is going to do in our lives as a family. So like new things are great. I'm drawn to the idea of a new covenant. And new always doesn't mean better, right? The fact that it's new doesn't mean that it's better. But in this context, God is still committed to this process and he has not given up on the relationship and he plans to put measures in place to ensure the success of the relationship. And who wouldn't like a better relationship with God? I am in on that. So the factor of newness is important and even more thinking of Lent as like a renewal moment, a renewal process, or a time to contemplate and to fast from whatever so that you can be renewed in anticipation for the cross and the resurrection and then all the great things that God has prepared for the rest of the year. I think the motive of newness fits quite well. Closely related is the fact of it being a covenant. It is an agreement, right? It's a sealed agreement that God will establish with Israel, with people, and they will always be God's people, right? And God will always be there for them. So that security and safety and promise and assurance that we get through covenants is something that I am drawn to as well. I want some assurance in my life, and I'm sure we all want some assurances in our lives. So preachers, consider the theme of renewal and covenant making as a preaching point here.
I think what I'm hanging on to too is this idea that, yes, it's renewal, but it also requires commitment on both sides. So when you were talking about skill, lama, like teaching something, in this period of Lent, there's an opportunity to put in practices that better support my commitment to God as well. It's never too late. And however that renewal takes place, there is some commitment on my part to practice. So that's where I'm also holding on this idea of renewing my own commitment and faith and my part of this covenantal relationship, because it is not just God rewiring me, but on some level, my willing commitment to that process as well.
That's right. That's right.
So, Paul, I think, that seems like a really great place to leave our listeners. And I want to thank you for your work on this passage.
Awesome. Thank you.
Friends, we hope you found something helpful in our discussion today. I know I did. And remember that you can find an episode on just about every passage in the lectionary on our website at firstreadingpodcast.com. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And hey, if you found this helpful, leave us a review on Apple or Spotify or wherever it is that you find us. And let your friends know. Until next time, I'm Rosie Candlethal.
And I'm Paul Esser. Have a wonderful week preaching.